You know, I told you we were going to try to finish this up, the book of Acts, before the first frost, and we just might make it. After today, we only have one more message in the book of Acts. Can you believe it? And if so, if it doesn't get down to freezing this week, we'll make it. So, you know, I'm praying that we'll do that. Now, last week, we've been following, of course, the growth of the and expansion of the church, and particularly here lately, we've been following the Apostle Paul. And as you know, last week we were listening as he was before Agrippa, Herod Agrippa, and his sister Bernice, because Paul has appealed to Caesar, which will take him to Rome, and the Roman governor Festus didn't have any charges against him to send him with. And it's not a good thing if you're the governor to send somebody to the emperor without any charges. So they brought him before Agrippa, hoping that they could find some, but that didn't work out. In Acts 26:32, Agrippa said to Festus, "This man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar." In other words, I don't find anything wrong with him. Now, that sounds like a good thing, but as we discussed last week, what he said there, that he could have been set free if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, that really wasn't true, because we know that God wants him to go to Rome, and God is leading him to Rome. And the fact is, if Paul had not appealed to Caesar when he did with Festus, he would have sent him back to Jerusalem, and there were 20 assassins waiting for him to come back. So, we know that wasn't really true, and so God is moving now to send him on to Rome, and I think it's interesting there are still no charges. I can't imagine, we're not told in here, I can't imagine what Festus put in his letter. And it may account for what happens with Paul in Rome, because when he gets there, there's certainly no immediate trial, as we'll see. But that's where we're going to pick up the story today. It's time for him to go to Rome, and that's a big deal. Rome is basically the center of the world at this point. And the emperor is the most powerful person in the world. And this is who Paul has said he appealed to, that he wanted to go see. So let's pick that up. This story begins in the autumn, in the fall of 59 AD. This is 26 years after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. And that was also the same year that Paul was met by the Lord on the road to Damascus and had his conversion. So he's been a Christian now for 26 years. And he's in his late 40s at this time. Let's begin by reading Acts chapter 27, verses 1 through 12. Not only has he been a Christian for 26 years, and not only is he in his late 40s, which to me doesn't sound that old these days, but for them that was pretty old. And the things that he had been through, if you ever read through 2 Corinthians, where he talks about all the things that he's been through, it's a lot for somebody to take, okay? So, picking it up in chapter 27 here, starting at verse 1. When it was decided that we should sail for Italy, who's we? That's Luke, right? And we also find that there are still some of Paul's companions that have been traveling with him that are with him also. When it was decided that we should set sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to the centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. That was the centurion's name. So it's Paul and some other prisoners. They're sending a bunch of prisoners to Rome. Now, Paul had appealed to go to Caesar. I doubt any of the rest of the guys had appealed to go to Caesar. They're going to Rome not of their own accord, okay? And embarking on a ship of Adramidium, which we'll see in just a minute, which was about to sail to the ports of the coast of Asia along the coast of Turkey there, we put to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. You may remember Aristarchus. Aristarchus was Paul's traveling companion. We saw him first in Acts chapter 19. He and a guy named Gaius, when they were in Ephesus, were the ones that were dragged by the mob into the Ephesian theater, right? Remember Aristarchus? And we see that from that time on, he's been traveling with Paul, and he's gone to Jerusalem with him. He was there when he was arrested, and now he's going to be taking this voyage with him and with Luke. So we know at least those guys are there, and there may be others that he's been traveling with. And it says, the next day we put in at Sidon. All right, I want to show you a map of where this is going to go today so that you can get an idea of where that's going on. Can we pull that map up, Paul? Sidon is in, anybody know? Present-day Lebanon. It was Phoenicia, it was called Phoenicia back then. It was part of the province of Syria. Yep, there it was. Okay. It was there for just a second. Okay, there we go. Okay, so they're sailing from Caesarea, and you can see that they're going to Sidon. Yes, there where Paul is pointing with his handy little pointer. Now, that's their first port. Now, I want you to see something else about this. They're going where? Rome, right? Okay, and you see where Rome is all the way over there. Now, I want you to look at this route that they take, okay? Normally, if you were sailing from Sidon to Rome, where would you go? Would you, you know, you're going to see, you could go straight across, right, if you had the right ship, okay? But as you can see, they're going to go up and around Cyprus, over to Lycia, which is in Turkey, to the point of Myra, over to Cnidus, and then they're sailing down to Crete, and they go down to the bottom side of Crete, and then they go off just way off into the ocean here, and you see that little swirl that heads down toward Cyrene, which is in present-day Libya, okay? And they end up over there in Malta, okay? Let's talk about how all this works out, okay? So it's not exactly a straight journey, okay? On a straight trip with good weather and all that kind of stuff, it would take anywhere from 20 to 30 days probably normally to make this journey. We're going to see that it takes just a little bit longer than that. So the next day they put in at Sidon. And like I said, Sidon is in Phoenicia, ancient Phoenicia. It's present-day Lebanon. Now, you may remember that Jesus had healed a Syrophoenician woman. Do y'all remember when he did that? That happened at Sidon. So Jesus has been here, okay? And when the church was persecuted in Jerusalem following the death of Stephen, and the people were dispersed everywhere, some of them went to Sidon. And so the church was founded there by Christians that had come out of the persecution in Jerusalem, and the church had been founded there. And so there was already a church, and Paul and his companions had stopped here on the way to Jerusalem at the end of the third missionary journey. So he had friends here in Sidon. Now, this is in Lebanon. And there's an interesting thing about Lebanon today that sets it apart from all the other countries in the Middle East. You know what it is? It's got a big Christian population. It's a predominantly Muslim nation, obviously. 41% Christian. There's no other place in the Middle East that's like it. 41% Christian. And that's because of these Christians that had founded the church there and because of the strengthening of the church that had gone on by Paul and others. Today, I'm sad to report that ISIS has about 3,000 fighters that are massed in the mountains that border Lebanon and Syria, and they have announced their stated intention to go in and annihilate every single Christian in Lebanon. And starting back in August, they began to make border incursions into Lebanon, and they've been going in, killing Lebanese soldiers and beheading them and doing what they do. So their intent now is to kill all the Christians in Lebanon. That's their intent all the way across the Middle East. You know, as they establish this Islamic State, they want to annihilate everybody else. Now, I don't think God's going to let them do that. There's been a Christian presence here since the time of Christ, really. Like I said, he went there and healed a Syrophoenician woman. I suspect a few people got saved at that point. Then the church grew out of that. But that's kind of where they're living today. Now, it says that Julius, the centurion, he treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. So, now, all these other prisoners, I'm pretty sure he's not letting them off the ship. You know what I'm saying? But he lets Paul go, and it says he lets him go to his friends who were part of the church there in Sidon to be cared for. This is an interesting thing that we need to recognize, because as you read through the letters of Paul, you will see that it appears that Paul had some sort of disease or infirmity. And you can imagine from the life that he has lived and the fact that he is in his mid to late 40s, he's probably got a few physical issues. So the centurion lets him go there to be cared for. And you'll see that as Paul's friends go with him to Rome, there's always somebody with him. There's always people ministering to him because he has some infirmity pretty much from this point on in his life. And it says, then putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus. As we looked on that map, you could see that they went, instead of going underneath Cyprus, they went kind of over the top. And I'm not a sailor, so I'm just telling you what it says in books, okay? But I understand that the lee is the part of the island that is the part that is sheltered from the wind, okay? So there's a strong wind that's beginning to blow. Like I said, this is autumn. It's kind of late in the season. And there's this wind that's beginning to blow. And so they sailed under the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria. Alexandria is in Egypt. So this was a pretty good-sized ship. They'd probably been a smaller ship that just kind of hopscotched along the coast up till now. But now he finds a ship from Alexandria, a larger ship, that's sailing for Italy, and they put us on board. These ships would most often carry grain from that region over to Rome. And so he put them on board that ship. We sailed slowly for a number of days. We arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. This is still in Turkey. And as the wind did not allow us to go farther, he wanted to just go farther, you know, west, but couldn't do that. We sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmone. So they had to drop down with the wind and go under the island of Crete. Okay? Crossing along with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, which is on the south part of Crete, near which was the city of Lysia. Since much time had passed, so this means that the voyage is not going as quickly as it might have, okay? Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, because even the fast was already over, Paul advised them. Now, what does it mean the fast is over? The Yom Kippur, that's right. It's the Day of Atonement that he's talking about. Today we call that Yom Kippur. That happens at the end of September or in early October. This year it was October 3rd and 4th. So this tells you kind of what time of year it was. Now, the Jews typically, when they would sail from Pentecost, which happens in May, up to the Feast of Booths, which closes out that happens in the days that immediately follow Yom Kippur. And that was the sailing season, because after that it wasn't safe to be out there in the Mediterranean. And it said that the Romans, they considered sailing after September 15th to be iffy. And if you got beyond November 1st, or November 11th, they said it was suicide. So now they're getting into the wrong time of year. And I'm sure that just had to do with the fact that Paul had been sitting there and they finally got the healing and hearing and they finally said, go. And even though it was the wrong time of year, if the governor says go, the centurion says, yes, sir, and they go, right? So they're coming into the wrong time of year here because winter is approaching. And so it says that Paul advised them, saying, sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. That's a pretty strong warning. And that word that he uses there, the Greek word that he uses for perceive, is the Greek word thereo, which means to look at or gaze upon. So it's possible the Lord gave him some kind of vision. Or when it says perceive, it may just be that that's what he felt in his spirit, you know. But he said, I perceive this voice is going to be with injury, with much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot, that would be the guy that's steering the ship, and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said, and because he wanted to get his prisoners to Rome. And because the harbor there on the south side of Crete where they were was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided, and that's the majority of the sailors, they decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, which is a harbor on the farther along on Crete, which faces both southwest and northwest. It's a protected harbor. And they figured, we can stay there and we can winter there, okay, because we've kind of missed our season here. Now, when the south wind blew gently, they've been having a wind that's been mostly out of the north and out of the west. Now, the south wind blew gently, and they thought, well, okay, we can go do this now. They had, supposing they'd obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete, staying close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind called the nor'easter, a northeaster, struck down from the land. So this big storm, and these storms, it's Euroculo in Greek, which means it comes out of Europe, and the second part of that means out of the east. This big storm comes up with a giant wind. You know what nor'easters are like. We know that along the eastern seaboard here, and you know how bad some of those storms can be. This is one of those giant storms that comes along, and this one's a big one. When the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. Running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed, so they get to the south side of Cauda out of the wind a little bit, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. These larger ships would carry smaller boats in the back. And those were, you know, you could consider it like a lifeboat, or it'd be what, more often it was what, when they pulled into port, some of the crew would get off and they would go in and pick up supplies and come back. And they towed it behind the boat. But at this point, this is becoming very dangerous because that little boat's not standing up to the wind and waves so good. So they pull that on the ship. They secure it down. After hoisting it up, they use supports to undergird the ship. They would take big ropes and they would run them crisscross underneath the ship because the ship's made out of beams, sort of like my fingers. And in the waves, in pounding waves, those beams can start to come apart. So they would run ropes or cables up under there to hold those things together in a storm. So that's what they're doing. They're trying to get ready for this. And then fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis. Now the Syrtis is along the coast of Libya there. It's not far from Tripoli, Libya. The Syrtis were these reefs made out of sand, like sandbars out there. And they were like quicksand. And they would literally, so ships would be blown up there in these storms. The quicksand would suck them in. And it was well known as a graveyard for ships. So they're concerned that this wind that's out of the north and the east is going to push them down to the coast of Africa. They're going to end up in those quicksand pits along the ocean there, and they're going to be sucked down and die in that ship graveyard. So it says they lowered the gear, which could have been like the mainsail or some of the gear. If you're sailing along and you need a break, you can put stuff out in the water and it kind of slows you down because ships are made to go with the wind and go fast. If you want to slow them down, you throw like the sail and stuff in the water and drag it along with you as a break. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard. This is more stuff with their own hands to try to slow this down. Get this, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. What happens on a ship in these days when you can't see the sun, the moon, the stars? Anybody know? You're lost. You have no idea where you are. There's nothing to navigate on. Their GPS was broken. And so the satellite was down that day. The storm was messing with it. They had no way of knowing where they were, so they are totally lost. And they think they're going to be pushed into this coast of Syria, and they think that that's probably where they're going to die. So it says, and this is, by the way, this is who writing this? Luke, right? All hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. So it wasn't just the sailors, it wasn't just the soldiers, it wasn't just the prisoners. Even the believers were giving up hope at this point. Now, since they'd been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and he said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship." Remember, before he had said, I perceive that we may lose our lives here. But he says, now, there will be, take heart, there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, so God sent him an angel as an emissary. And he said to him, "Do not be afraid, Paul. you must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those that sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on some island. So the angel told him all this stuff. And he goes, hey, it's, you know, this is bad. I know. Everybody's lost hope. But don't be hopeless. Buck up. This is going to be okay. We're probably going to lose the ship. We're going to blow up on some, you know, some island somewhere. But it's okay. We're going to live. When the 14th night had come, that's a big storm. You know what I'm saying? That's a big storm. They've been out there for 2 weeks. Okay? When the 14th night had come, as they were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, that's the sea that's in between Italy and Greece and goes down to Crete and Malta, okay? When they were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the soldiers suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms. And fearing that we might run up on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. Because you can't see what's going on. Their flashlights were out too. Okay. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, the sailors by now are panicking. They're thinking, we're going to run up on a reef. We're going to die. So we're getting off of this thing. Okay. As the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under the pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these sailors stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. And the sailors are like, dog, what did they do that for? As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, today's the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food. Why were they not eating food? You ever been on a ship in the middle of the ocean and you don't feel like eating anything? Okay, so they've been on a 14-day fast. I'm sure it was a spiritual adventure for them, okay? And have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength, for not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread. And giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Now, he's not taking communion. He's just eating, okay? All right? Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves, and there were in all 276 persons in the ship. So you've got the sailors, you've got the centurion and his soldiers, you've got the Paul and his guys, and you've got the prisoners on the ship. 276 of them. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship to get it up higher in the water, throwing out the wheat into the sea. That was the rest of their cargo. But they were throwing out the rest of the provisions because they figured, we're not going to need them any. We're not going to need any more food from here. We're either going to live or we're going to die, but we're not going to need food. Now, when it was day, they didn't recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosening the ropes that tied the rudder. So now they're really starting to whip along, but at least they've got rudder control to try to go. Then hoisting the foresail, which is the little sail at the front of the ship that helps steer it, to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow stuck, and it remained immovable. And then the stern was being broken up by the surf. So now the boat is starting to come apart. And they're still a ways off the beach. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. Why would they want to kill the prisoners? Anybody remember? They're responsible for them, and if they don't show up with the prisoners, what happens? Life for a life. That's right. They get killed, okay? So they're thinking, we just need to kill the prisoners because we might lose one. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. This is a good centurion, isn't it? He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. Now, I could say this is a miracle, and you would probably believe me, but let me show you an even bigger miracle. Can we put that map up there? Again, it says we were brought safely through when we learned that the island was called Malta. Now, the wind is blowing. It's a nor'easter. The wind has been blowing them. They expect it to end up down around Cyrene, which is in Libya today. That's where they thought they were going to go. Look where they ended up. The wind never blows that direction in the Mediterranean. Ever. It's a stone miracle that they ended up there. And they had no way of knowing because they hadn't been able to see the moon or the stars or the sun in 2 weeks. So that's why they didn't recognize the land. They had no idea. They thought they were going to be somewhere in Africa or something. Instead, they're way over here in Malta, which is, by the way, a province of Sicily, which is part of the Roman Empire. How cool is that? And Malta is not only a province of the Roman Empire, it also happened to be the main port on the trading route between Africa and Rome. And they just happened to hit that one island in the midst of that whole big ocean. Now, this island, Malta, had originally been settled by the Phoenicians, the people who are from around Lebanon. And the inhabitants are identified, and if you're reading the King James Version, it may say this in your Bible, as barbarians. Anybody have that in their Bible? Mine says inhabitants of the land, but in the original Greek it says barbarians. And they don't mean that because these were uncivilized people. What they meant was that they spoke a language that was not Greek. They spoke... I got some. Is that you? I like it. It's like going... See, we're talking about the islands. We got an island tune going over here. Cindy's providing the background music. That's great. So that's where they're going, is to Malta. Now, that's, like I said, they're barbarians not because they're uncivilized, but because their language is a dialect of the Phoenician language. That was their first language. Most of them probably did speak Greek because it was a big trading post, and ships would come through there going on their way to Rome, but that's why they called them. And like I said, it's a miracle they're there. So, it says, we learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, it says. Now, what does that mean, unusual kindness? Now, who's on this ship again? Prisoners. Yeah, with soldiers guarding them. Bad prisoners, people who are going to be taken to Rome. These are not your good guys, okay? But it says that the people showed them unusual kindness because they kindled a fire and they welcomed us all. Because it had begun to rain and it was cold because it was winter and nobody is supposed to be sailing in this time, okay? When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened onto his hand. And this viper was known to be poisonous on the island. So, it says, when the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." Now, justice, do you know who this justice is? Yeah, you've all seen her. Justice is that goddess figure that holds the scales in her hand. The scales of justice. That's who this is. They're talking about a goddess. Justice has not allowed him to live. He must be a murderer because this poisonous snake grabbed onto him, and so now he's going to die. He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said he was a god. Yeah. Of course. That same thing had happened in Acts chapter 17. You may remember Paul and Barnabas were together, and Paul healed a guy who had been crippled from birth, and they decided that they were Zeus and Hermes. Remember that? And they were trying to worship. So, I mean, he must be a god. He's not dead. Okay. Now, in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. When it says the chief man, it means he's like the governor, the ruler of the island, okay? It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. So, if you've ever had that, this man's pretty sick, right? And he's older, it's his father. And that's a bad thing. And Paul visited him and he prayed. Putting his hands on him, he healed him. When this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. They also honored us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. They gave them their provisions from their own stores. After 3 months, we set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, and that's where we're going to stop today. We will pick up the rest of their journey to Rome next week. But they, how long did they stay there? 3 months, okay? So they spent the winter there. Now, I don't know if you know anything about Malta today. When I was in elementary school, I actually had a girl in my elementary school who had grown up in Malta. I mean, as much as you could grow up if you're still in elementary school. But she had lived on Malta, so I learned a little bit about the island. I learned a little bit more today. Malta is 98% Catholic. Yep. It has more than 360 churches, or one for every 1,000 people. It's one of the most Christian places on earth. They trace their history back to, guess who their patron saint is? The Apostle Paul. And the first bishop of the church in Malta, anybody want to guess who he was? Publius. First bishop of the church in Malta, that's right. So he was converted, and the church was established there. And since that time, Malta has been conquered twice by Muslims. But the Christians have persevered, and the church has not only survived, but thrived there. As a matter of fact, not only are 98% of the people there, Catholics and or other kinds of Christian, their rate of people that actually go to church is about 75%. They're serious about this. Okay. So, now, what can we learn about this story? Well, there are a couple of verses that I just want to focus on briefly today. In Acts 27, 24 and 25, God said to him, or the angel of God said to him, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told." And in Acts 27, 44, it says, "So it was that they were all brought safely to land." I want to tell you today, we can look at the Apostle Paul and we could say, well, you could see that God was really with Paul. He had his hand on him. He has a special plan for his life. You know something? God has a special plan for your life too. Every single one of us, God has a special plan. When God let Paul know that he and all who sailed with him would be saved, how were things looking at the time? Yeah, very grim, not good. They didn't even know where they were, and in fact, it was so bad in Acts 27:20, Luke tells us that all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. They had given up all hope. So it looked really bad, and that includes Luke. But it didn't turn out that way, did it? They were all miraculously saved, and this is a truth that we see in the Bible that I want us to focus on for just a minute. God will have mercy, and He will save lives. And sometimes He will even save nations and cities because of just one of His children who is among them. Let me give you some examples. Noah. Noah was a righteous man, and because of him, his family was saved. And because his family was saved, the entire human race was saved. Abraham. Abraham interceded for Lot in Sodom, and Lot and his two daughters were rescued out of the destruction of Sodom. Joseph. Things went badly for Joseph, didn't they? Ends up in Egypt. But how'd that turn out? He rescued his father, his entire family, and the people of Israel. Rahab the prostitute. Because she believed God and did the right thing, her father and her entire family got rescued from Jericho. Esther. Because of her, the Jews who lived in the Persian Empire survived. Jonah, much to his chagrin. Jonah, because of him and his obedience to God, God saved the people of Nineveh, that mighty city in Assyria. And Jesus, of course, who saved the human race, who saved people from every tribe, every language, every nation. And here the Lord grants Paul the life of everyone on this ship. Now, we're not told whether Paul was praying for himself. We're not told whether he was praying for other people. But it does say that God granted him their lives. This happened because of Paul. They were protected from certain death because of God's favor toward Paul. So what's the message here? It's that God cares for his people. And he sometimes has mercy on other people just because of one of his children and their faithfulness to him. Why is this important today? Have you paid attention to what's going on in our country and around the world? You know why this is important today? Because we need to not give up hope. The guys on that ship had abandoned all hope of being saved. But God had a different plan. And it was because of the one person on that ship that God had was having favor on at that minute. See, here's the thing, guys. If we're the last Christian standing, it doesn't matter. God can still save. God can still move. He can save cities. He can save nations. If there's just one of us standing, and guess what? There's a whole lot more than just one of us. This is important. And no matter what happens to us, we cannot give up hope. We are not hopeless, and we should never give up on the goodness of our God. 1 Chronicles 7:14 says this, "If my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sin, and I will do what? Heal their land." Hosea 6:1. Hosea says to the people, "Come and let us return to the Lord. For he has torn, but he will heal us. He has stricken, but he will bind us up." Jesus, in speaking of the great tribulation that is going to come on this world, and I know some people think we're in it now. I'm not sure I subscribe to that, but there is a great tribulation that's coming on this world. And Jesus says in Matthew 24:21-22, "For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short." Today, like Paul, I think the Lord wants to remind you. I think he wants to, for you to remember, first and foremost, that God is with you, no matter what trouble may happen to you or around you. God is in control. That's the first thing we need to remember. Secondly, God wants to remind you that because he loves you, he hears you when you pray, and he answers your prayers. And third, he wants you to know that because of you, because of us, because of the people of God, he continues to have mercy on people that don't deserve his mercy. None of us deserved it either. He will continue to have mercy as long as the people of God remain faithful and do not lose hope. He will continue to do that until the return of Jesus Christ, when he comes to judge the world in righteousness. And guys, that hadn't happened yet. And we don't know when it's going to happen. All throughout history, people have thought, well, these are going to be the end times. Certainly in World War II, when that came along, people said, this is the great war to end all wars. This may end our world. We're still here. We don't know when God's coming. Our job is to remain faithful as he is faithful to us. So don't be afraid of anything that people or this world can tell you or do to you. Pray with all your heart. Pray with all your mind. Pray with all your strength. Pray with all your soul. Pray for your family, your friends, your church. Pray for this city. Pray for the nation. Pray for the world. Pray for your brothers and sisters in Christ, because God is listening and he will answer your prayers. But I encourage you also, pray especially for God's great mercy to be extended to the lost, even to those who are our enemies. The centurion and those soldiers on this ship, they were not naturally the friend of Christians. But God saved every single one of them because Paul was there and God's favor was on him. And if you're in Christ, then I want you to remember this. You are his child. You're his daughter. You're his son. He pays attention to that. His favor is on you. You think you love your children? You have no idea how much he loves you. You're the apple of his eye. You're the one that he loves, not with just a love for now, but with an everlasting love. And here's the thing you really need to remember. You have the favor of God on you. Remember that. And God has called us together for such a time as this, to stand in the gap for those who do not yet know God, for those who, like us, before we got saved, may be his enemies. We need to be faithful in these days and never lose hope. And when the enemy comes and tries to make you afraid, you need to tell him to step back, because you are a child of the living God, and he is with you forever and ever and ever. Amen.